Beer is one of the most widely consumed beverages in the world, and there are apparently some 20,000 different varieties. We likely won't be able to cover them all during this Food Friday Please Explain segment, but we're going to try. And joining us now is Garrett Oliver, the brewmaster at the Brooklyn Brewery. He's also editor-in-chief of the Oxford Companion to Beer, the author of The Brewmaster's Table, and one of the foremost authorities in the world on the subject of beer. Welcome to our show.
Great. It's great to be here.
And
I
also,
love your show.
And also, we invite our listeners to give us a call. Our number is 212-433-9692. You can write to us on our show page or find us on Facebook and Twitter, where our handle is at Leonard Lopate. Is it too basic to ask what exactly is beer?
No, it's actually not too basic at all. I mean, beer is a really strange food product in that most people who might drink it every day often don't really have much of an idea what it is. So I think that's a good place to start. I mean, beer essentially is any beverage that's made from breaking down the starches in grain into sugars. Then you will spice it with something, cool that down, and then ferment it. And you're going to end up with beer. But, of course, the devil's in the details.
So it doesn't matter whether the grain is wheat or oats or something else?
Well, it matters a lot, but you can make beer from all of those, and people often have over time. The main grain that people use these days over the last several hundred years would be barley, because barley has any number of different attributes that really lend themselves to making beer.
And then hops and malt?
Malt is what you make from the grain. I think we should probably circle back to that, because you need malted grain in order to actually convert your starch to sugar.
Mm-hmm.
But the hop is actually the spice. Now, many spices used to be used, and there used to be blends of spices that people used, and that's to provide some kind of counterpoint to the sweeter flavor which is in there from the malt. So in wine, you'll have a counterpoint in the flavors of the wine, which will be your acidity or tannin, so that your wine doesn't taste flabby. Well, in this case, you're going to use your hops, which give you bitterness, but also a very wide range of flavors and aromas.
What did humans start making first, wine or beer?
People dispute that pretty widely. And it really depends on.
Well, you're in the beer
to.
Business.
I think we have to kind of give it up to mead in the first place, because mead can pretty much make itself, you know, in a good rainstorm. But it's unclear which came first, but they were both very early.
And is it likely, as you suggest, with the mead, that it was discovered accidentally?
Almost certainly discovered accidentally. Probably somebody had taken some grain which had started to sprout. And that sprouting process these days is part of the malting process. But it started to sprout, and they thought it was going to go bad, so they made it into a porridge. And while they were heating it up, it turned sugary. And like, well, that's interesting. And then from there, all you have to do is to get some water into that sugar, and the natural microbes in the air will ferment that grain sugar out into beer. But
well,
first, you have to get the sugar.
Wine pretty much started in the same area and spread across Eurasia. But you find beer all across the world. So people kept discovering it separately, independently of each other?
They did, because it was a natural part of what would happen to grain if it got sprouted. You heated it up. And during that heating process, what happens is that the sprouting of the grain has developed these enzymes. And the seed is like a little egg, you know, that barley seed. And it's got starch in the middle. And when it starts to sprout, it develops enzymes. And the enzymes break the starch down into sugars. And then the thing burns the sugars for energy, gets leaves out, and becomes a plant. Well, if you sprout it for a few days and then you dry it out, you capture those enzymes. And when you make a porridge called the mash, you break down all the starches into sugars. So we're actually using the natural enzymes the plant was going to use for its own development and taking it in a much more interesting direction.
Claude Lévi-Strauss wrote about being with Amazon Indians, and they would chew a starch and then spit it into a communal pot and then chew it again. And the saliva would wind up turning the starch into alcohol.
I remember doing that experiment, and you might too, when I was in science class when I was a little kid. And you used to sit there and chew the bread and chew and chew and chew until the ptyalin, which is the particular enzyme in your saliva would break down the starch into sugars. Thankfully, there are other ways of doing this, and most of them are a lot less laborious and a bit less disgusting.
And you don't do that at the Brooklyn Brewery.
The only time we chew grain is when we want to check out the flavor of a particular barley variety.
A listener is on the line. John from Paramus. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, Leonard. I'd like to know what's the difference between, not what the difference, but what is ale as compared to regular beer and stout?
Well, that's a good question, and I think that many people don't know the overall families, if you like, of beer.
There are a lot more. Lagers, pilsners, bitters, cream ales, India pale ales, ice beer.
There are dozens. At the Great American Beer Festival, and this year was my 21st year judging, I think we judged 88 separate categories under which there were many subcategories. Beer has a much, much wider range of flavor than wine does, and I say that as a wine geek. I love wine, but the range of flavor doesn't come anywhere close. So we're starting with ale and lager. Those are the two main families of beer. And the difference between them is a warm, relatively short fermentation for ale and a long, cold fermentation for lager. Now, many people tend to think that ale is dark and ale is strong, as opposed to lager being light and not as strong. But there's actually not even the slightest kernel of truth to that. So it really is the two main families of beer that are separated by different species of yeast that ferment in different ways, and it's a cold fermentation versus a warm fermentation.
But
if you're
alcohol...
drinking beer, the only reason why you care is because ales tend to be fruity in their characteristics, and lagers, you taste kind of ingredients. They're more straightforward.
But the alcohol can be pretty much the same, the alcoholic content.
It could be exactly the same, and in fact, ales are no more likely to be strong than lagers.
Now, in this country, alcoholic content was determined by law for a long time. Are we seeing a change in that?
Well, in most areas of the United States, you've seen a change a long time ago. So here in New York State, I don't recall that we've ever, at least since I've been drinking beer, had any restrictions at all on the upper end of alcoholic content for beer. Now, the average for most beers is 5%, and that's an average across the whole country. But at Brooklyn Brewery, we make beers that start at about 3.2% all the way up to about 12.7%. So just in that, you kind of see what I'm talking about, the difference of range of flavor. We kind of cover a very wide gamut.
My guest is Garrett Oliver, who, among other things, is the editor of the Oxford Companion to Beer, and we're talking about beer on today's Please Explain, inviting your calls at 212-433-9692, or you can write to us on our show page, or tweet us. My handle is at Leonard Lopate. A number of people want to know what the difference between beer and stout, and is draft bass a stout? The English bass?
Draft bass would actually be a pale ale. So under lagers and ales, which are those two families, you have what we call styles. India pale ale is a style. Pale ale is a style. Stout is a style of ale. It's a type of ale, and it's made with malts that have been roasted until they're black like coffee beans and have some coffee and chocolate sort of flavors and aromas. So that's going to be a stout. And there are relatively light stouts like draft Guinness, which surprisingly is very light in calories and very light in alcohol, to very strong stouts that'll be 12% and up. So just looking at something, you're not necessarily going to understand everything about it. But when you say stout, stout is always going to be dark, at least almost black, and it will contain roasted malts and have some of those flavors there.
Now, since we're talking about something that's made of barley or wheat, water, hops, yeast, does that make beer nutritious? I read, for instance, that Queen Elizabeth I drank strong ale for breakfast.
Beer is very, very nutritious. Real beer. Just the same way that we might talk about a loaf of traditional bread is going to be a very nutritious thing, especially if it's whole wheat. However, of course, it's possible to make bread that has very little nutrition. You know, and we have the same thing in beer, really. So, but, you know, really naturally made beers are very nutritious, especially if they still have their yeast in them, in which case you get your full range of vitamin B, 1 through 12. And in Germany, for certain problems, they will actually, doctors will actually still prescribe a half a liter or a liter of particular types of beer to people every day because they're really good for you. So, and Neolithic men definitely knew that.
So how do you explain beer bellies?
Beer bellies, interestingly, have been correlated not particularly with the beer itself. Beer is not any more fattening than wine is. In most cases, most of those calories are coming from the alcohol, and it really depends on how much you're drinking. The thing is that a lot of beer drinkers, at least over the last 50 or 60 years, have been drinking fairly empty beers, and they've been drinking a lot of them, and then they're having chips with it, and they're having fries with it, etc. So the wine drinker who over the last 50, 60 years has been generally a more prosperous person has also tried to shy away from the junk food a little bit more. So it turns out that it's more of a lifestyle thing and doesn't actually have anything to do with the drink itself. But of course, you know, beer has changed a lot in the last 20 years. And now these days, a lot of people are drinking beer for flavor. And I think you're going to see the idea of a beer belly going away.
Well, there was a time when there were a lot of local breweries, and then the big national ones just came to dominate. Now we have an explosion of microbreweries and an amazing increase in the popularity of beers that aren't made by Anheuser-Busch or Miller's. Do you think that's why it has suddenly become the favorite of so many people, including a whole hipster generation?
I think so. I think that what it really is about is that people are really into flavor. And when I was growing up in the 70s, you know, you went to the supermarket, and the supermarket had three kinds of cheese, and there was basically one or two kinds of bread, you know, and I'm sure you remember those times, too. The thing was, that was never a natural environment. It was really quite abnormal, you know, over our history. Food was always really interesting, and beer was interesting. And in, you know, the late 1800s, in Brooklyn, you had 48 breweries. They made about 10% of all the beer in the country.
But Schaefer was the only beer that you needed if you were having more than one.
I'm afraid that wasn't quite true if you wanted to have an interesting life. I mean, in a way, beer is like music or anything else. You know, if you listen to only classical music, well, classical music is wonderful. But, you know, there are many other types of music. And you're really sort of shortchanging yourself if you don't discover jazz and rock and roll and, you know, any number of other things. And so people are really treating beer the way that it always had been treated in the past, which is one of life's fun foods, wonderful to drink, interesting on a regular basis. And today, you know, craft beer, it's the new affordable luxury. You know, you can turn every meal into something which is so much more interesting for less than a cup of coffee at Starbucks. And, you know, it's virtually a miracle from the culinary point of view.
Are there national styles? Are Pilsner more likely to come from one area than another? Is India Pale Ale really from India?
India Pale Ale was a style originally made in England to be shipped to colonists in India. These days, India Pale Ale is, I would say, the flagship style of American craft brewing. The style is bitter. It is dry. It has a big hop flavor and aroma, which goes anything from being floral all the way into a big citrus and pine sort of note. For those who aren't familiar, the hop is actually a little artichoke-shaped flower. It grows on a vine that grows to be about 20 feet tall. Hops are varietal like wine grapes, and they have very different flavors and aromas, and they are the nearest botanical relative, I'm afraid, to cannabis.
Well, but that's not the reason that they make you a little high.
No, you're not going to get much out of trying to smoke hops, I'm afraid.
But would Pilsner, for example,
would
Pilsner be more likely to be from Eastern Europe, or do we see those kinds of differences?
The Pilsner style originally is out of Central Europe, from Czech Republic, in fact, which is where Pilsen is. And so when you take a name like Budweiser, Budweiser is the beer from Budweiser, Česká Budějovice, in what is now the Czech Republic. Pilsner was beer from Pilsen. But styles, just like styles of food, travel. So when people in the United States started to make these types of beers, they would name it after where it was from. And you often are going to see that. So Pilsner, or a version of Pilsner, if you like, became the standard beer across the United States and was eventually made into a kind of Bowdlerized version, which was the American mass market beer, and still is. And what we're seeing now, I think, is not a trend or a fad in beer, but a renaissance and recovery.
Now,
we always had the most interesting food culture in the world because we had everything and everybody. We also had all of their beer and all of their beer styles, and then we kind of gave it all away. But the same thing happened to our food, too. It was part of an arc, kind of continuum of American food, and we kind of lost everything in mid-century, in the last century, and now we're just getting it all back.
Now, you sent over 3 bottles of beer. They're in what I would call wine bottles. They're large. They're not the little beer bottles we're used to. And they are a Cuvée de la Crochet Rouge Rose, or Rosé, Black Rose. Ops, and a Green Market Wheat, all very special beers.
Well, these are special beers, but there are many breweries in the United States that are making beers that are along these lines. And I think one thing for the listeners to realize is, okay, these beers are in what most people would call a champagne bottle. They have corks, they have a wire cage, etc. I just want everybody to realize that this is in fact a beer bottle, and it was always a beer bottle, and champagne is in a beer bottle. So, the champagne people have much better PR than we do. But these are made by the technique of re-fermentation in the bottle, which we do out here at Brooklyn Brewery in Williamsburg, Brooklyn. And so these beers go into the bottle completely flat. We add some priming sugar together with some new yeast, and we do a secondary fermentation in the bottle, which gives you a very nice, soft, but high level of carbonation. And I think the first one to taste will be the Green Market Wheat, which we have made for Grow NYC, which is our green market system here in New York City. And as a founding member of Slow Food USA, I'm really proud that we got a chance to do this. And it's more than 70% New York State ingredients, both raw wheat and barley grown by Peter Martins up in upstate. A little bit of honey from our friends at Tremblay Farms near the Finger Lakes. And, I think eventually we can get green market wheat to be 100% content from within, say, 100 or 200 miles a year.
Now, is that unique to this to you, or is this a beer that I might have found elsewhere in the world?
Oh, I think, beer at one time was very, very local and often was a farmhouse product. So the farm would actually grow the barley themselves, and the farmer would malt the barley himself, and he'd grow the hops himself and make beer. And so traditional beer really was a farm product until it turned into business. Of course, it was the Egyptians who really got that going a very long time ago and turned what had been a home industry, if you like, into a big commercial concern.
Now, before we get to the other beers, I do want to sneak some callers in. And Josh from Long Island, hi, you're our first caller.
Oh, hi. My question was about barley and if the grocery store variety will sprout and if it can be malted to use in beer making. And if there are other, what the spectrum of maltable seeds are.
Well, many seeds are maltable, and when you say maltable, what you really want to know is, one, is the seed viable, meaning if you keep it warm and soak it in water, is it going to sprout? I know that certainly, and many of us know that if we've ever made wheatgrass or something like that, that the wheat that you might buy in a supermarket will sprout without any difficulty. There's generally no reason why it shouldn't, but I personally haven't seen whole barley many times in a supermarket, so I can't be 100% sure, but I don't see any reason why it won't.
Patrick from Manhattan, hi, you're on the air.
Having lived in Beer Nirvana, called Germany, my quick question is, how do you feel the large American brewers stack up against the German purity laws?
Well, German purity laws say that you should only make beer from barley, malt, yeast, hops, and water, which at the time in 1500s, you know, was basically a consumer protection to make sure that people didn't use all sorts of adulterations. And it's helped the Germans over time make wonderful, pure styles of beer, but it's also kept their beer culture kind of stultified and a bit boring compared to the rest of the world. So they have very high quality, but not very many types. In the United States, we had mass market brewing, which has, to a certain extent, very high quality, but a very low level of flavor. So if you can think of it being like cheese, you know, American processed cheese food slices. Well, they come out the same every time, which is basically one way of looking at quality, but they're just not very interesting to eat. And that's kind of what happened to American beer. It got turned from something really flavorful and interesting into something spectacularly dull and uninteresting. And now we're kind of getting the interesting part back. But quality, as the brewer defines it, is basically a matter of hitting your target. So when I talk to homebrewers about it, you know, I often say, well, you can decide for yourself whether you like Kenny G, but he can play the saxophone. the question really is a matter of style.
Yeah, if you're a jazz fan,
I'm playing, you want to hear.
Now, we have very little time. I was interested in a history of New York, in fact, when it was New Amsterdam in the 1600s, when people drank beer or ale because water supplies were contaminated. I was wondering about that. Did the whole population walk around a little buzzed, including the kids?
Everybody. Everybody, pretty much. Beer was a replacement for water. People didn't know why, you know, beer was always fine, but water could kill you. Now, of course, we know now that since during the process it was boiled, you've killed off any microbes that might be there, and there are no known pathogens that can actually survive in beer. But they did make very, very light types of beer. One was called small beer. Later, some of them were called family ale or dinner ale, and they would be 2 or 3%. And these were beers that were just for drinking and hydration on a, you know, on an all-day basis. And so, yes, children did drink beer. They didn't drink strong beers, but they did end up drinking it.
Now, we have very little time, but you sent a beer called Black Ops. Should I assume that this is a CIA-made beer?
No, it's not. It's actually, it was a black op for us here at the brewery. We decided to make a strong barrel-aged, bourbon barrel-aged imperial stout. And basically, those of us in the brew house made it without telling anybody else the company that we had.
And it is black.
For many months. It is black. And if you pour it and smell it, you'll get a big sort of American oak character, chocolate, coffee. It's a beer that's hard to find. We only make a small amount of it every year. But those who find it, so far, they seem to like it an awful lot.
Yeah, it's quite delicious.
It's a really growing thing. It's putting beer back into barrels where, of course, it has been for the last few thousand years.
So beer hasn't been made in barrels. The barrels impart the taste, the oak taste that we expect when we drink wines.
Exactly. But one thing that's interesting to me is people will look at our barrel aging program and they say, wow, that's great. You're taking some ideas from the wine people. But of course, until very recently, all beer was in oak barrels, just like all wine and all olive oil and soy sauce.
So industrialization changed all of that.
Exactly.
The big breweries. Well, now we're back to the old ways. Everything old is new again. And I thank you so much for talking with us today, Garrett Oliver, brewmaster at the Brooklyn Brewery, editor-in-chief of the Oxford Companion to Beer, and also the author of The Brewmaster's Table, one of the foremost authorities on the subject of beer. It's been a pleasure talking with you on today's Please Explain.
Great talking to you, too. And those books, of course, make the perfect holiday gift.